This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, a presence in the sky. When you read Fanny Howe's work, there's one tale that keeps recurring. It often starts like this. A young boy with the soul of a poet prepares a bag with almost nothing in it. Let's say a book and a comb. Then he takes his book and his comb, says goodbye to his mother, his father, his home, and starts walking out into the wilderness. Often the boy turns out to be a prophet of some kind, a seer, even a saint. But that comes later. First, there's a part of leaving behind the comforts of home and choosing the chaos of the wider world. It's not hard to see why this tale appears and reappears in Fanny Howe's pages. She was born in 1940 into a family of prominent Bostonian intellectuals, the daughter of a playwright and a Harvard law professor. At 17, she left all of that behind and moved to California, where she spent her college days protesting the death penalty in the Vietnam War, before leaving to report on the boycotts and sit-ins in the South, where, once again, she left to battle racist housing policies in the Northeast. After marrying and divorcing her second husband, a Mexican African-American editor with whom she had 3 children, she threw herself into the fight to desegregate schools. To care for her kids, she crisscrossed the country, from teaching job to teaching job, and learned, as she describes it, to live on smoke alone, to find the free clinics, the kind people, the food stamp outlet, and to exchange free childcare with other mothers. What sustained her all those years were the words of fellow seekers, Francis of Assisi, Meister Eckhart, St. John of the Cross, Dante, Simone Weil, and her Catholic faith. Now, after a lifetime of moving and wandering...
Hi, I'm still here.
She's back home.
I'm so happy that you wanted to talk to me. So why don't we start with very early childhood? Because you probably don't live too far away right now from the house that you grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I was wondering, what do you most remember about that house or that street?
I do remember being happy, but especially when I wasn't indoors. It's a beautiful place to grow up, Cambridge, for a child. And it was especially in those days because there weren't that many cars and it was safe. There weren't murderers lurking around. So I was always whirling around on my bike with my dog and friends. So it was a pretty idyllic childhood, I must say. Because now, you see, I'm making basically the same walks since I'm living near to the apartment we had at that time. Everything is suffused with about a million layers of memory. And the weather here is what rules the day. It's like being in a theater production every day. Whether, you know, how bright will the lights be and who will be in the audience. It's kind of such an event, the weather in New England.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's also all over your poetry and your essays. What do you think draws you to the weather?
Well, I think... movement, the motions of things, and the sense of the extent to which living life, biology, goes so far out into the universe. It's incredibly emotional to me to watch the sky. And when they were bombing Iraq, for instance, I went out and looked at the sky at night just to get my perspective back. As I'm sure the people in Iraq did too. Yeah. But anyway, it's a hugely, it's so much about color and light. And it's very metaphysical for me, the sky and the trees.
Yeah. Did you have that sense as a kid?
I did. I mean, I basically remember looking out the window and feeling a presence that uh-huh. was much bigger than the household and wanting to go to it. So that sort of trailed me around for a long time, that feeling of presence.
And is that a feeling that you sometimes lose and then find again, or is it always there?
It is interesting. It's often not there in terrible times until after whatever it was, it's over. And then I keep thinking, who was it who was there with me when that happened? I kept feeling there was another person in the room with me or whatever, but I don't know who it was.
Yeah. Yeah, you did live through some terrible times. What was the first inkling of that? Of that the world seemed to be in such a state of disarray?
I would say it began with the war. It penetrated indoors and on the radio, that sort of ominous feeling about the war going on. And it was especially colored when the war finally ended and my father could come home. So there were all these dimensions to it.
Yeah. And do you remember, because, you know, you were very little, right, when your dad was in the war in Europe, do you remember if the adults around you shielded you at all from the danger that he was in, or did you know?
No, we knew. There was no shielding. Partly because my mother was not the type to shield anyone from anything. She was very dramatic.
Oh, I see.
So, every day was a drama about where in North Africa he was that day and who got shelled and all of that. So it was pretty present.
That's so interesting, because I feel like even as a little kid, when you can sort of read the mood of the news or of dramatic things going on, you don't actually understand what they're saying. I mean, at least in my experience. Do you remember something coming over the radio and you knew what they were talking about?
It was, as you say, it was more of like music. Mm. It was like hearing Hitler's voice and hearing Roosevelt's voice on the radio in the living room going all yeah. the time. Whether you understood it or not, you got the picture from the quality and the emotional tone of the voice.
Uh-huh.
Hitler's was particularly unattractive.
And it's so hard to describe an absence of someone or something, right? But do you remember, what was your conception of what a father even was, you know, since he wasn't there?
I know, you're absolutely right, because people always assume a child needs a father.
Yeah.
But how do we know they need a father? you know what I mean? Or even a mother, if there isn't one there and you're being taken care of. But I think in this case, it was so suffused with the news and with danger, he took on a kind of mythic quality to me. And when Roosevelt died, I thought he had died. Everything was confused.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah, of course. And then when he came home, did you just want to be with him all the time?
Absolutely all the time. I adored him. And he and I both loved dogs. So there was always a great deal of bonding around which dog we walked at night and things.
Oh, just, wow.
Oh, at that level. Yeah.
Yes. You know, Fanny, there were so many things that you actively partook in. I mean, you fought for busing to desegregate schools. You battled racist housing practices. And I think when you had your small children that you started a community health clinic. Is that right?
Yes, in the neighborhood with wonderful neighbors. We all did it together.
How do you even start a health clinic? I mean, how does that work?
Well, one of the people was a nurse who was a neighbor, and she went right to, I think it was the Brigham Hospital in Boston, and asked them if they would help us start a clinic.
Mm.
So we were given directions on how to do it, basically, with the authority of the hospital behind us.
And who did you serve?
Everyone down there. It was mostly Puerto Rican population in Jamaica Plain. I lived there for 14 years.
Yeah.
And then there was all the busing thing, so I had to, because my oldest child has kinky hair, her sister has straight hair, and my son is sort of halfway between. And I was told I couldn't send the kinky-haired one to the same school as the one with straight hair, because they were trying to balance out racial characteristics. So I had to drag them out and make them go to schools based on race, because that was Boston then. It was like being in South Africa, really.
Oh, totally.
I mean, I did fight like a demon, and I finally got all three in one school that was about to close. It was so pathetic. Oh, God, I got to know the Boston school system pretty well.
Yeah. But it was also, I mean, you were also a single mom by then of three small children, and you were teaching. How did you find the time?
I will never know. I literally, I don't know how I did it. I just did it. It was day by day.
Yeah. Yeah. You write in your essay, The Winter Sun, people who are destabilized by historical forces are more intelligent than the secure ones who have got the formulas in place. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm fundamentally a complete coward. I grew up with lots of books around me and music playing and sort of a good school. All of that was functioning very well. But in a way, it weakened me. I wasn't equipped to go out and do the things that people who have grown up in real trouble know how to do. So everything that I did that looks like cavalier and brave was done in a state of terror.
That's so interesting. I'm just so curious, is it born out of necessity? Is it a sort of courage of despair, or is it something else?
I think it's, I think for friendship is how you do it, actually. In the end, it's a matter of having other people by your side. And we used to do, I always lived communally with other women and children. And so that made, I think everybody should do that. Because we really all helped each other get through the day.
Yeah. Was there ever a tension in you between the activist that knows how to do things and the philosopher, the doubter?
I think because of my growing up in the family I did, I just assumed that politics was part of living, that you did do those things, that you contributed your energy to what was wrong. But I always preferred to be alone in my bedroom writing or reading. And so I spent, my children and I all spent a lot of time in bed together, reading and eating.
That sounds lovely. Would you read them children's stories or poetry, or what would you read them?
I would make up stories, actually. I would lie flat on my back and just go into a stream of consciousness, tell them stories. So we had continual additions to...
Yes.
You know what I
yes.
mean.
Yes. What was your go-to story?
Well, mine were usually like Hans Christian Andersen kinds of stories, very much about nature, about a rabbit in trouble and things. So it was they weren't human stories. They were always the natural world in danger.
And was there a sense that inside with your family, with your children, that world was whole?
Yes, there was that sense. Mm-hmm. Although it was before the women's movement, and it was a very unstable period for girls growing up. It was definitely on the cusp of the women's movement, but not there yet. And so the boys were really brats. I mean, that generation of male was a bad batch for women. Huh. Because they had not had to change in any way either. So there was a kind of brutality in their position as males.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fooled, the girls. We didn't know anything.
And do you feel like that changed in your lifetime? Or do you feel like that, as you say, batch of men is just a wasted batch?
We're just seeing them all getting their comeuppance. Just look at Harvey Weinstein and everything. I mean, that was that batch. And Trump was that batch.
Yes. Is that also what led you to seek your own, the purpose of your own life in different directions, you know, maybe more in the life of the mind or?
Yes, I mean, I think it was, again, kind of probably half a cowardly choice, but I didn't want to go through those fights for my whole life. And so I made a choice to live alone pretty much with my kids and post-kids, to just have a lot of quiet around me.
I was wondering if you could read this poem. It's called Everything.
I know that poem. Yeah.
But I'm also wondering if there is a way that you can bring me in. I don't know exactly how, but maybe there's something you can tell me to listen for or think about. I'd love some help getting into this poem.
Yeah, okay. Well, that whole set was written in Washington, D.C. when I was teaching at Georgetown. And I did a sort of temporary rental of the house downtown. I can't even remember the name of the district. But it was Washington, D.C. is very haunted, I found. And the house that I lived in was four stories high and deeply haunted by the man who had built it, who also was the architect for the Capitol building. And he was a very bad-tempered man. He was known for his bad temper, and nobody liked working with him. And one day he went in and told them to put up a beam between two walls. And they kept saying, it's not ready, it's not ready. And he shouted and screamed and told them they had to. So they went up and the beam fell on him and killed him. So it was his house that seemed saturated with bad temper, but also had the whole sense of Washington, of democracy and ideals.
And what makes Washington, D.C. such a haunted place?
I think it's sort of like it's built on water. It's sort of soggy and like a swamp. Underneath the buildings, I find it fascinating and beautiful. But there's something about it that isn't quite right. It feels... You feel sort of that you're dead already when you're there. Did you want me to read it anyway?
Yes, please.
Infinite nesting pushes all matter towards emptiness. Child nodes, tree droppings with a root element of null. None is always included in every cluster of children. nothing in nothing prepares us. Yet a fresh light was shed on immortality for me, climbing the stairs, firm foot first. Everything was in the banister, crows on branches, crickets, architects, handsaws, and Democrats. Red moon at 3 a.m.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you gave this little introduction. It really helps me feel out the dimensions of the poem more. I was still wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about Nothing in Nothing Prepares Us.
That the awareness of nothingness doesn't make it any easier to live in the world. I mean, you can say it's all nothing, but saying that doesn't prepare you for the shock of being here. It's hard to describe, I think.
Yeah,
maybe it doesn't mean anything.
I mean, anything that's worth describing is hard to describe, right?
I know. I think during the 70s and 80s, there was a movement almost of irony all over the country and in deconstruction, and many poets were saturated in irony. And it became kind of sickening. I can't explain it. But I think it all was blasted away with 9/11 when the buildings went down. And now you realize nothing was not a good enough way to explain it, to just say everything means nothing. And, well, that line, firm foot first, comes from Dante climbing out of purgatory. He said he climbed firm foot first, which meant has a whole load of theological meaning. But in his sense, it was just you always have to put the strong and life-affirming gesture first. It just poured out. I can't really say exactly.
When you say it just pours out, is that how you experience writing?
Basically, yes. Because I write by hand. So it's whenever it comes to me, I have to grab my pen and paper and write it down. And then I spend ages analyzing what I had put down and trying to make it sound. So it's true that it bursts out, but then I often can ruin it by picking at it too much. But but the weirdness of that is that what are you actually looking for? And that's sort of the nothing and nothing too. You can pick at your poem until you kill it.
Huh. Right.
So
is it as if that's a very permeable boundary almost, that something can very quickly turn to nothing and back again?
That's right. And you can never find that first fine, careless rapture of the outburst.
Yeah.
And the clarity of a kind of spontaneous action.
And so when you moved back to Cambridge, when did you move back?
I think it was about 8 years ago. Well, I mean, right. The point is I kept moving back and away again, back and away, so I don't really know.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you kept circling around this place that you've spent your childhood in. And you said earlier that when you go on a walk today, that every place you pass is sort of layered with memories. And there's this line in Love and I, your latest collection, where you write, "What if you think of time as a long and everlasting plane? You can pass across it any which way you turn." Given that sense of time, that it's not a line, but something that you can sort of move about in, I'm just curious to know if life becomes ever more predictable, if it sort of ever makes sense.
No, never. Never. Because you see, everything is so mysterious. That never changes, that feeling of being astonished by existence, by being here at all.
Huh. Do you feel like the older you get, the closer you become to transcendence?
Well, I think, I mean, my beloved friend John Giorno just died.
You
probably know that, but he was the most beautiful and transcendent person, and at the same time completely hilarious and practical. So I was telling him about visions I had when I was in the hospital, and I was pouring out these fascinating things that went through me, and he said, "Oh, that was the drugs." I thought I was on my way to God, you know. And he, so that was the right response.
I was wondering if you could read the poem Footsteps.
Footsteps, okay.
And I was just also wondering if you could, could help me inside this poem, just like you did with the other one.
I'll just say something, and then maybe afterwards. Now, again, great. You see the Dante thing is in there. I've never arrived into a new life yet. Have you? Mm. But I'm speaking it generally to any person who's either reading or listening to me. So let me just read it right along. I have never arrived into a new life yet. Have you? Do you find the squeak of boots on snow excruciating? Have you heard people say it wasn't me when they accomplished a great feat? I have. Often, but rarely. Possibility is one of the elements. It keeps things going. The ferry with its ratty engine and exactitude at chugging into blocks and chains. Returning as ever to mother's house under a salty rain. Slave up, slave down. There we are. Done.
Thank you. Do you want to guide me through it a little bit?
Well, there are multiple associations in it, but I lived out on Martha's Vineyard for 22 years, coming and going all the time on the ferry. So that's sort of the ferry chugging and blasting. And it's also, again, back to Dante and the ferry being ferried across from life to death. But the sort of position of, well, this is very Simone Weil to say, being a slave. She always said that the sea, the ocean, is an obedient slave to God, and it just does what it's told to do all day, every day. So it was sort of in that spirit of deep unconscious feelings still continuing to drive you forward, slave up, slave down. And that would be crossing back and forth on the ferry.
Uh-huh.
Does that help?
It does help. And when you say, I have never arrived into a new life yet.
Well, the new life would be being transformed, becoming a new person.
It's so interesting. I feel like people constantly talk about being transformed, about reinventing themselves. So do you feel like that's not really what's going on?
Well, I think when you're young, it is going on because you are changing.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think you can ever change your nature or whatever you want to call it, your personality. It's sort of, you're born with it, and there's nothing you can ever do to not have that little figure in you. But you can change how it feels.
And what is that for you?
For me, it's like a little figure. like a little invisible figure, sort of like the one I was describing earlier, the sense of someone being with you who you can never get rid of.
yeah. And then you write, possibility is one of the elements. It keeps things going.
Right.
What keeps you going?
I guess I have hope. A completely unreasonable hope that there's always, like Pandora's box, when all the evils in the world are let out, plus one little tiny flying thing called hope that flies out of the box too. So I feel possibility is in everything, is inherent in being, in material, like light. Really, light would be the word I would use.
And on a normal day, what gives you hope?
It is partly beauty that gives me hope. And books, people's voices I can dip in and out of.
Yeah.
And my friends. And above all, children.
Children in general?
Or well, your first children? Beginning with I have six grandchildren, so with them. Mm. And then on the streets, I just love children and watching them.
So when the weather is nice, do you go for a walk and then sit on the bench and watch?
I do, yeah.
What's the last thing that you saw that riveted you?
You mean of a child? Or of anyone.
Yeah. Anything. A child or a dog being funny or a squirrel being absurd.
Well, this morning a bird whistle came out of a brick in a building. It was bizarre. It was surreal. I was just walking along. Suddenly a kind of chirp I've never heard before was going inside the building's wall. So I went around the corner looking up the wall, and there were too many shadows. There were lots of black shadows. One of them could have been a bird.
Maybe that's that invisible presence that you've always felt.
I know.
It's just a bird in the wall.
Exactly. It's maybe insanity.
Oh, Fanny, thank you so much. I really love talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Fanny Howe is a poet, essayist, and novelist who's written over 40 books, including The Winter Sun, Second Childhood, The Needle's Eye, Gone, and her most recent poetry collection, Love and I. If you go to the Poetry Foundation website, you'll find a recording of Fanny Howe reading a long lyrical poem from Love and I, titled The Definitions, which I've listened to I don't know how often, but it still makes me tear up every time. If you want even more, the website is a great place to start, with essays by and about her and many, many of her poems. The music in this episode is by Todd Sigafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.